Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Clearly, some of the key players in the unfolding political season in this country are women. It seems that more American women than ever before are involved at all levels in public policy issues and aspire to or hold political office. Many observers believe Hillary Clinton has a very realistic chance to become our country's first female president if she decides to run. With that in mind, a recent article in the Washington Post by a University of Missouri St. Louis political scientist caught our eye. Even though Mrs. Clinton has kept everyone guessing about her political intentions, UMSL's Farida Jalalzai doubts Mrs. Clinton can win if she runs for president. That got us wondering about women in politics in general. Farida Jalalzai chairs the political science department at UMSL. She's the author of Shattered, Cracked, or Firmly Intact, Women and the Executive Glass Ceiling Worldwide. She joins us in studio, as I say, as does Vivian Eveloff, the founder and director of the Sue Scheer Institute for Women in Public Life at UMSL. Its nonpartisan mission is to encourage the participation of women in political and policy leadership. Ladies, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you. Farida, I'll begin with you, if I may, about Mrs. Clinton. Why do you think that her chances are not too keen to win the presidency?
Mainly it was stemming from the fact that the institutions that are in place in the United States, which seem like a daunting obstacle for women to surpass, are still going to be in place. And so to some extent, she doesn't have any control over that fact. And the baggage that she seemed to carry in 2008 will still be there and maybe having additional things to encounter. As far as maybe potential scandals, the Benghazi scandal hasn't escaped her. And because she's the perceived front runner, even though, as you say yourself, she's declared nothing, the Republicans have had every opportunity now to sort of mount a campaign against her. And we also know that with front runner status comes this seeming vulnerability in a way, in that you can always be the one that slips, right? And so we have so many expectations that are positive that are placed on her, but you know, to what extent is it realistic to expect that she can do this in 2016 when she couldn't do it in 2008? I have questions about.
Well, there's a lot of water under the bridge since 2008, and the things that you mentioned all seem to me are things that can be overcome somehow.
And none of these things are insurmountable. I just argue that the likelihood is fairly small that she'll be able to surmount these problems. We also have to bring in the fact that even if she does win the Democratic primary, it probably is the Democrats' more daunting task for a Democrat to win in 2016, given the issues that, of course, Obama has experienced in holding the White House the last, it'll be 8 years. People are probably going to be looking for some sort of change. And I think that's what the historical pattern has typically been. And so none of these generalizations are hard and fast rules. And I think if anything that I've learned from my research is that lots of these hypothetical scenarios don't necessarily play out the way that you expect them to. Every campaign starts anew. There's campaign strategies that can be employed to troubleshoot for all of this. And clearly people are already thinking about, I'm sure, ways that they can offset some of the potential attacks and the attacks she's already going up against. So, but my awareness of the comparative literature and the comparative patterns suggests that it would be a really, really difficult thing to imagine.
Vivian, you buy into this?
Well, I don't have the research basis that Farida does, but I have a lot of experience. And I think that it's been a remarkable case already to look at the personal attacks upon her, people who have never seen her medical records, who are sure that she is not healthy enough to be president.
Such as Karl Rove.
Correct. And it's the sort of downside of being in the lead, as Farida points out, that you get the bullets first. And I think she's dealt with some of them. I think she's ignoring a lot of them, which is probably the wisest thing to do, because once you engage it is often not to your advantage at this point. I mean, she's 2 years out. Everybody is 2 years out, and we don't really know what the country is going to look like by then.
Unless I miss something, I don't think that anything that's been mentioned so far relates specifically to gender.
Well, there are those who think as an about-to-be first-time grandmother, she could not possibly leave her grandchild in favor of the White House. Something that nobody ever talks about. I mean, I don't know how many grandchildren George Bush had when he ran or how many more he had while he was in office. I guess in the beginning he had none, and now he has at least one. But nobody talked about it. They didn't talk about whether it would ruin their daughter's weddings. I mean, it was none of that kind of consideration that you hear a lot when a woman steps forward.
Farida, I'm sure you share that opinion.
I completely agree with Vivian on a lot of things. And this is a great example that she used to illustrate the difficulty in having to deal with this type of scrutiny that doesn't always manifest overtly gendered, but please, it seems like it's hardly an accident that the first time you have the possibility of a grandmother, that's an issue that's raised. But we've had grandfathers. We've had President Obama has two young children, right? And this seems to be something that's much more likely to come up when the candidate is a woman. And it's just one of the examples that can be pointed to already before she's ever declared anything.
It's another way of saying that she's too old.
And people are saying she is too old, too,
sure.
Basically. Mm-hmm. So with the health concerns as well, and there are some explicit examples. I think it was Rush Limbaugh back when she was running in 2008 who said that something to the effect of who wants to see an aging woman in the White House. Again, these are overt examples of the treatment that women might get versus the treatment that a man might get.
You know, I was just looking at my notes here because the recent firing of Jill Abramson as editor of the New York Times, she was cited, they made it out to be a money issue, but it turns out that she was perceived as tough, demanding, and abrasive, and that's the reason she lost her job. And these are qualities that generally, for that kind of an executive position, you would admire in a male counterpart.
Exactly.
Yeah. So this is what's going on. Go ahead.
You don't hear men called bossy or pushy. Mm-hmm. Those are among the many adjectives reserved for women with a negative connotation, whereas they might be leadership, toughness, you know, tenacity, a lot of other things if you wanted to find a gender-neutral term.
Another part of the Hillary Clinton story, though, and we're still a good many months out, is the fact that there is no announced Republican candidate yet. And Republican candidates are going to face the same kind of scrutiny that any Democrat would.
I think that there's going to obviously be a high level of scrutiny that any presidential candidate is going to receive, regardless of the partisanship. But what I think is a little bit different about Hillary Clinton is that there's clearly been this mounting array of arguments and evidence that people have been trying to use to make her seemingly unqualified or unfit for office. And so I think that she has captured a lot of the attention, though, because there aren't similar examples that we can point to on the Republican side, except for maybe Marco Rubio, right? Mm-hmm. And so with her, she's sort of different from a lot of female candidates in that some of the difficulties that female candidates have had in the past, especially when we're talking about running for the presidency, is a lack of coverage. Hillary Clinton does not lack for coverage.
Yeah.
The question that comes up is the types of quality of coverage that she has received, and has that been detrimental to her chances? And to some extent, yes, it has been.
But Vivian, going back to the gender issue, doesn't it seem to you that the glass ceiling for female candidates in the political and public policy world has in fact been cracked? 20 female senators, I've forgotten what the number is overall in Congress. I think it's about 100, including the House, something like
right.
that. And we've got 5 or 6 female governors. There are a lot of women out there who have been successful.
Not so many female governors. Not that 5 or 6 is the wrong number, but out of 50. And there have been a lot of women who have run for governor and have not made it. We just saw that in Pennsylvania where they had their primary election against an incumbent Republican. There were 2 female candidates and 2 male candidates, and there was much discussion about there should only be 1 female because they would divide the female vote, whatever that might be. But nobody complained about the fact that there was more than 1 man, and indeed a man who was the front runner in many ways won that election.
Has this changed at all in the last, I'll just say last 10 years, last 20 years? Has it changed at all?
Well, the so-called last year of a woman, or the woman, was 1992. And those tend to occur every 20 years. We have redistricting. We have a lot of other factors that play into that so that there's some open seats and opportunities for women, and women run, whether it's the state legislature or Congress. And so we did have a little boost in 92, and we've had some more in Washington since then. But on the local level, we don't see that. We see the number of women, for instance, in the Missouri House of Representatives, just about fixed. What has changed, we've got between 35 and 40, 41, depending on the particular election year, in the Missouri House, is that number used to put us sort of midstream among the 50 states. We were the 24th, the 25th, the 26th state. We are now the 30th state, because other states have moved further ahead than Missouri has.
Farida, do you want to elaborate on that?
Well, I'll elaborate as far as nationally, we have been seeing women make very incremental gains for the most part. They have held record-breaking numbers of seats in the Senate, but 20 out of 100 seats is still historically good. But is it parity, and shouldn't we be along a bit faster and as far as growing those numbers? But then I think about it globally because of my interests, and I see in many ways that we are so behind. We're so behind half of the world as far as women's representation in legislatures worldwide. And it has continually caused, I think, a lot of people to ask questions about, given the fact that we have a huge percentage of the people who earn professional degrees now and higher degrees in general, women form obviously a majority of those degree recipients now, if we're looking at bachelor's, master's, and now professional degrees. Women are making some inroads into the legal profession, which is typically a pipeline into politics. But we're still really actually losing ground, comparatively speaking, when we look at the United States in relation to the world. And so I think that there's some optimism that we can point to, some, strides that have been made, positive strides. But at the same time, there should be more progress. And how can we maybe close that gap that is still huge when we're talking about 20% of the Senate, when we're talking about 18% of the House? It's just not enough. If what it is that's important to you, and I think democratically, it is important to have parity in political positions.
One area where there is not parity is in colleges. More women are graduating from college these days than men. And that's an interesting side note to all of this, isn't it? I have to take another break. Let's do that. We'll come back and continue this conversation. We're talking about women in politics and a disparity therein, or is there? My guest in studio is Farida Jalalzai, UMSL political science professor and the author of Shattered, Cracked, or Firmly Intact, Women and the Executive Glass Ceiling Worldwide. Vivian Eveloff is the founder and director of the Sue Scheer Institute for Women in Public Life at UMSL. Back to continue that conversation, we'd like to get you in on it as well. How do you view the role of women in today's political and public policy landscape? Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at SDL on air. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation on women in politics in America today, and as in fact around the world today in just a moment. But here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Republican U.S. Senator Roy Blunt met with officials at the VA hospital in St. Louis this morning about concerns raised over mental health care. The meeting came about 2 weeks after the former chief of psychiatry claimed that veterans seeking mental health treatment in St. Louis often wait a month or more because too few patients are seen. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon was in St. Louis this morning and will visit Kansas City later today to reaffirm his opposition to the General Assembly's actions in the final day of the session. Mr. Nixon says there will be fiscal impacts to, quote, special interest exemptions and giveaways. And Illinois lawmakers are reviewing a scathing audit of an anti-violence program created by Governor Pat Quinn. The report is becoming an issue during the governor's re-election campaign against Republican Bruce Rauner. Illinois Auditor General Bill Holland presented the audit at a hearing of the Legislative Audit Commission today. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stopublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation about women in politics today. My guests in studio are Farida Jalalzai, UMSL political science professor and the author of Shattered, Cracked, or Firmly Intact, Women and the Executive Glass Ceiling Worldwide. Vivian Iveloff is the founder and director of the Sue Scheer Institute for Women in Public Life. Vivian, let me come back to you. What do women bring to the table in today's political world?
Well, they used to think it was brownies, but I think we've gotten beyond that. And there's research that shows that women look at issues differently, that they tend to work differently. They work more collegially than men do, and they are willing to listen to everybody's perspective so that they're more open-minded, and then quite determined. But they also generally specialize in issues that have been considered women's issues over the years, health, family life, kind of the hearth issues, as opposed to banking, insurance, highways. But that's changed some, as we have seen women, particularly in cabinet-level positions, on issues different from that. We have more women as generals and admirals today than ever before. So in areas particularly where merit is a concern and experience and background, and that not the public making the decision but an executive making the decision, they have made real progress. Yeah.
You didn't mention the judiciary, and I know you're keen on that.
I am indeed. And we look at the three women out of the nine Supreme Court justices in Washington and say, well, isn't that great? That's a record. But if you look at the Missouri Supreme Court, where there are seven justices, three of them are women, which is a much bigger percentage. So I think from that perspective, women who have gone to law school and worked hard and determined that their interest is in making fair law, as opposed to working in the private sector, perhaps, and making more money, that we can be very proud of the state.
Farida, anything that you would add to the list that Vivian just gave us of what is brought to the table?
I think the only thing that I would add, and political science research backs this up, what Vivian has said, controlling for even partisanship and ideology, that on top of that, women in politics provide powerful role models. They send cues to people that politics is open, is more open to people, that democracy is more in place, that it's a more of a legitimate system that we're operating in. And that, I think, is something that could ideally be used to create candidacies in the future for young women.
What's going on here? Are women being stiff-armed by the good old boys, by their men counterparts and colleagues? They're just getting a late start and getting into the game. What is happening?
Wow. That's a huge question. And if I were to answer it properly, I'd take up the rest of your show and maybe the rest of the afternoon. What's happening is, in part, yes, they're sometimes being strong-armed. Sometimes they're just being excluded. Sometimes they're just not being recruited. We know that even with their higher levels of education, we're still tracking men and women into different fields, right? And so a lot of it is still socialization. And we know that there's this still continued, I guess, lack of efficacy in a way among women, that somehow they don't think that they're qualified to hold public office or to run. And so I think in many respects, there's obviously so many different parts of the story, and some is going to be more blatant and discriminatory. It's going to be more subtle in many cases, though, now, even though there are going to still be blatant examples of discrimination. So that being said, I think that organizations like Sue Scheer really do a tremendous job of trying to demystify the political process for women and to start the next generation of young girls into thinking more, not just about professions in maybe in politics, but just as far as becoming contributors to the public sphere, however you want to do that.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to Vivian now, because that is what you do. What are you seeing?
I'm seeing that young women that we work with are less likely to wait to be asked, but that is historically women's biggest barrier, which is sort of self-imposed. Mm-hmm. My observation is that, to go to a sports analogy, that women tend to see being in office as a baseball game. You have to get to first base, which may be the school board or some other local office, and then maybe you move to another slightly larger, maybe it's the state legislature, and then perhaps you could run for a state senate. But it's very much the baseball metaphor, where you have to touch all the bases. And men, for men, it's football. It's grab the ball and run with it, and not make any stops along the way if you can avoid it.
We've got to make it a Title IX sports metaphor. Is that
right? I suppose that may be the case.
All right. I want to go back to Farida with regard to what you said just before the break, mm-hmm. with regard to what's going on in the rest of the world, because we do seem to be behind many, many areas and countries in which it would surprise folks to think that we would be behind. I looked to Latin America, and I looked to parts of Asia and what have mm-hmm. you. Why, I'll give you another equally tough, difficult question here. Why are they ahead of us in this whole area of gender?
Well, I don't know if they're ahead of us as far as the whole issue of gender. What I can say is that women form a higher percentage of legislators, right? And they mm-hmm. are often executives, presidents and prime ministers. What helps explain that a lot goes back to the institutions again, and where we have PR systems, multi-member districts. Parties obviously may have an advantage in fielding different types of candidates. It's not a zero-sum game, as it is in the United States when we're thinking about single-member districts. And that's part of the explanation. Another part is that a lot of countries have adopted affirmative action, basically positive mechanisms to get women into candidacies and get women into politics in some areas where they wouldn't have any representation otherwise. And then a lot of it also can go back to the socialization process that unfortunately still seems to track women into areas that don't necessarily lend themselves to politics, even though that's really changing. And this continued, I guess, in a way, balancing act that you have to perform to be a professional woman in the United States, and how that wouldn't necessarily lend itself that easily to a public career, at least at maybe my stage of life. And that's maybe why women have tended to wait longer to start their political careers. And then if they're doing it sequentially, as Vivian was talking about, you end up getting a later start, and you feel like you have to cover all of the bases, then there isn't a whole lot of time, you know, left in your career to maybe go into higher and higher levels.
But Vivian, women outnumber men in this country. Are we close to the point where they're going to say, as a group, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore?
Well, I hear young women who are excited about a Hillary campaign. coming of age at a time when they could work for somebody that they see as a role model. So I think from that perspective, we may be getting there. But, you know, men and women vote somewhat differently, but there are a lot of other factors that are included when you make that analysis besides gender.
Yeah. Well, the female vote, women's vote, is not a monolithic vote.
No, it's not.
And I think a lot of women would resent even the implication that it is. And yet we hear it all the time, particularly with regard to Hillary Clinton. She's a woman. All women are going to vote for Hillary Clinton. I don't think Catherine Hanaway is going to vote for Hillary Clinton. That would be my guess.
And not to open up a can of worms, but I just will. Sarah Palin, remember Sarah Palin?
Who could forget?
But how there were actually people who somehow thought that Hillary voters would vote would ultimately vote then for Sarah Palin's vice presidency. And it's just, it's ignoring all of these different factors that would go into anybody's vote choice. And that partisanship is obviously going to be part of that equation. And it's not only going to mean that if a woman is running, that women are all going to vote for them. There's so many different factors that would be at work here.
Well, now that you've mentioned Sarah Palin, I was going to mention her as well, but I'm going to give you three names. I'm going to give you three names here. Sarah Palin, Michelle Bachmann, and Christine O'Donnell. Christine O'Donnell being the candidate in Delaware who vowed that she was not a witch at one point during her campaign. These women have been highly ridiculed in the national media, and I'm just wondering how much of an impact that has on women in politics. Vivian, do you have a thought?
Well, that opens up the question of diversity in the media. That so many of the loudest voices are men, who for one reason or another frequently find it difficult to find anything good to say about women candidates. There's a new documentary film out about Geraldine Ferraro, who I would add to your list, when she was the first woman nominated on the national ticket.
88.
And there was huge groundswell of excitement about her nomination. And in the documentary, which is fascinating in all kinds of ways, people who ran the opponent's campaign speak candidly about the fact that she was clearly carrying the ticket. And they had to figure out something to do to stop her. It wasn't enough to just run against Walter Mondale. And they attacked her husband on his honesty, his affiliations, all kinds of things, and it took them so off guard that the campaign never really recovered from it. And I think that is often the case, that women get attacked because of their family members and their spouses, as much as, you know, women who just get belittled by the press.
Of course, the fact that Walter Mondale, at the convention, when he was nominated, said that he was going to raise taxes had a lot to do with that campaign as well.
It did.
What do you think about, Farida, those names that I mentioned?
I think they all have their their own stories. But I think the takeaway really is that the criticism is part of a democracy, right? You should open yourself up to criticism when you're running for office. But what I think often separates Democrats and Republicans in a way is that Democrats are going to sometimes only view the discrimination that they seem to think occurs to Democratic women and be critical of that. Versus, and then on the other side, Republican women might, or Republicans might just pick up on discriminatory treatment of Republican women. And I think that so often the actual maybe larger debate gets so lost in a way in partisanship that we lose sight of how, okay, Sarah Palin should never have been subjected to a lot of the critical coverage that she received. That was more trivializing. Neither should have Michelle Bachmann. It doesn't mean that there aren't other types of arguments you can bring in that could be critical of their candidacies. The same goes for Hillary Clinton. And so what I would like to see come out of any kind of discussion about media and gender is maybe this recognition that here is something that we can unite on, that women, regardless of their partisanship, can be scrutinized negatively on things that should have nothing to do with their electability, whether it's their appearance or who they are married to or how many children they have. Are they going to be grandmothers? And unfortunately, we don't often have that unity as and it shouldn't just be a conversation women have. It should be a conversation that women and men have.
You know, Vivian, you mentioned the media a moment ago. There is some irony, I think, in the fact with regard to Sarah Palin that it was, uh-oh, and I'm having one of those moments, the female anchor from CBS that interviewed her and really brought, pardon? Katie Couric, mm-hmm. Of course. It was Katie Couric, I think, that brought Sarah Palin down. Ironic that a female correspondent did that.
Well, some could say Sarah Palin brought Sarah Palin down. It was Katie Couric's job to ask tough questions and a vice presidential candidate's responsibility to be able to provide good answers.
But you've had here you are encouraging women to get involved in politics and public life. You've had some female politicians who've come after you and your organization as well. I'm thinking specifically of Jane Cunningham in the Missouri legislature.
Well, sometimes women are their own either worst enemy or most constant critics. And I don't know what part of our DNA accounts for that but it does happen, and I'm really at a loss to explain it.
All right. Have to take another break. We'll do that now. We're talking about women in politics. We have some callers who want to get into this conversation. We'll bring them in when we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation on women in politics and the role that they play. My guests in studio are Farida Jalalzai, a political science professor at UMSL and author of Shattered, Cracked, or Firmly Intact, Women in Executive Glass Ceiling Worldwide. Vivian Iveloff is the founder and director of the Sue Scheer Institute for Women in Public Life. Well, one of our co-producers has asked me to ask a question, and it's a good one. What about minority women in politics? Are we seeing any shifting here at all? I'll start with you, Farida.
From my understanding, actually, the percentage of, say, for example, African-American women legislators really increased. And what the research has really tried to do is intersect gender with other factors, including race and ethnicity, and class. And when I look around the room at any Sue Scheer event that I'm at, I am continually struck by how many African American women are in that room, and they really seem to have a strong presence. And I think that offers a lot of, I think, important lessons as far as democratic representation.
Vivian, what are you seeing?
I'm seeing still a large number of minority women, African American women specifically, running for office and holding office, but more young male African Americans running for office and being elected. Often in seats that had historically been held by one woman after another. So I think the numbers are about evening out, although because many of the women have been there longer, they have more seniority.
Right. Here in Missouri, I think the representation is pretty good.
It is.
Yeah.
Given the fact that women in general are so underrepresented, they still contribute a lot to the diversity of the legislature.
Let's take some phone calls and get the audience into this discussion. Mike will join us from North St. Louis. Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi.
And speaking in so far as the 2016 presidential election, you were talking about the women's vote and so forth. You know, it's, you know, not divided, but have various factions. But I think more importantly, too, is African-Americans will not, I can tell you now, and I'm 64 years old, the Democratic Party at the national level, as far as I'm concerned, don't have a chance. We look at how we gave this 9 out of every 10 votes. We also have been the most vulnerable part of this coalition, going back to Nixon, you know, but still, you never hear us mention. You know, we don't hear nothing but other people's problems are trying to be solved and political capital being used up, even in the state. Them elections, whether the governors, auditors, or whoever they were, them races were not decided until 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning until they were counted here in St. Louis. But do you see any respect? I'm telling you, the African Americans at any, whether it's Hillary Clinton or whoever, it's, we will not vote, period. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Mike. Thoughts about that? I mean, it's hard to say what is going to happen, but Mike seems fairly convinced that this is going or not going to happen. The mm-hmm. African-American vote will be way down.
Mm-hmm.
It's somewhat off point.
Well, it's an off-year election, yeah. And there's usually fewer voters in off-year elections than there are in presidential elections, so that may be the case this year. We have to wait and see what the ticket looks like.
Well, one of the things that is being talked about now in this off-year election season is the fact that women are not likely to vote, and that could make a huge difference with regard to what happens in November. You look skeptical of that.
I only look skeptical because the prevailing pattern really has been for women's turnout to actually exceed their male counterparts.
In off-year elections?
Even in off-year elections, I'm fairly certain, although the pattern is much more stable in the presidential years. Hmm. And I want to date that back to maybe 1980.
Right.
So that's why the skepticism surfaces.
And there are a few contested elections. There's no contested statewide election. So those are all things that tend to depress turnout. On the other hand, there are some important issues on the August ballot as well as in the November ballot. And I'd like to think that women read carefully and understand that they have something at stake and that they will go to the polls.
Well, the Obama administration seems to be making an effort to do what it can to keep those issues in the forefront. Again, those issues that might be more attractive to the female voter. And I'm hesitant to even say that, given what we said in our mm-hmm. conversation before. It's not a monolithic group.
No, it certainly is not.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of debate, obviously, about what constitutes a woman's issue. Are they really deemed women's issues because they're stereotypically women's issues, but healthcare is something that obviously is more than a women's issue? Or is it really a feminist issue that opens up another can of worms about more talking about women's empowerment? And I think that when you bring up issues like pay equity, yes, clearly you'll find prominent women even, you know, saying that. That's not a priority or shouldn't really be something that's, you know, worked on. But I think that for the most part, women can agree on at least in theory, it being important to have equal pay for equal work. And I think the Violence Against Women Act shows the work that the female senators really, really did to some extent on bringing that back onto the table, that there are some of these issues that can connect women and that those are going to be, I think, different depending on the time and the place. But no, we don't want to overstate women as a voting bloc. But I think that there could be some shared priorities that are probably, not as salient, perhaps right now than they can be at certain points of time. I think about the students that I teach, and I think in many respects, unfortunately, they somehow think that women have achieved everything that they should have achieved, whether or not we're talking about the workforce and education and politics. And in many respects, I think over time, unfortunately, there'll be a bit of a wake-up call. But I think that there is something to these larger issues that women face that could bring more cooperation between women and men of different partisanships, really.
It wasn't a political issue, Vivian, but we got a pretty good look at this gender differences in pay with the Francine Katz trial and Anheuser-Busch earlier this month right here in St. Louis.
Yes, we did. Yeah. And I would say not only is the economy, jobs, and pay serious issues, and pay equity clearly a serious issue, but so are sales taxes. I mean, women tend to be purchasers for their family, and if sales taxes increase, they'll certainly be aware of that. There are a lot of issues that are pocketbook issues for everybody, and women, as a large percentage of the population, a large percentage of the voters, are not a bloc, but I think they give it some serious consideration before they vote.
Let's go back to the phones, and Bob in Manchester has been most patient. Let's bring him into the conversation. I think he'll backtrack a little bit for us, but go ahead, Bob.
Yes, I wanted to bring up the matter of historical precedent, which I think is relevant in this case. You know, right now, running for president involves like a 10-year commitment of time, 2 years during the running, the election, and then 8 years for the two terms. So Hillary Clinton, when she becomes president, would be almost 70. So if you go back in history and look at two interesting presidents, Ronald Reagan was the oldest elected president at 70, and he left office at 78. He developed Alzheimer's disease his second term, and the last 2 years of his presidency, for all practical purposes, his wife determined who he would see, what bills he would sign, what he did. We really had a woman president under her, though unelected. And prior to that, the same exact thing happened with Woodrow Wilson. After the end of World War I, he had a stroke for the last 2 years. His wife really became the first woman president in history because she also did the same thing that Ronald Reagan's wife did. She determined who he would see, what he would sign, what he would do. And so the point I'm making is Hillary Clinton would be 78, and this is the age that two previous presidents already had either Alzheimer's disease and stroke. I'd like your commentators to make a comment on this. Thank you.
Bob, thanks very much for the call. I'll just weigh in by saying that the two presidents that he mentioned in the minds of many people were among our better presidents. But Vivian, you would like to respond to that?
Well, women, as we know, statistically live longer on average than men do and are often healthier longer than men are. So I would say the risk is certainly no greater than it was with those two 70-year-old men that we've elected in the past. And I don't think that that, again, is a relevant part of the conversation about who would serve the presidency and the people the best.
It's a stretch, don't you think, for Rita to try to predict something like Alzheimer's?
You don't know. I mean, you have no idea what's going to happen to anybody as far as we all know from our own lives. From these basic indicators. The more interesting thing, I think, actually, that Bob said, though, was about the sort of unofficial capacities that women have held in influencing the presidency, whether or not we're talking about, well, often first ladies, basically, an unofficial position that can have a lot of influence. And we never really, I think, can firmly say this is exactly the amount of influence this person exercised. But I think that's the thing that surfaces to me is how we do have these women who've been able to exercise power, just not really officially and visibly, perhaps.
Let's go back to the phones, and we'll bring in Jerry from O'Fallon. Jerry, thank you for waiting. Go ahead.
Good morning. This is an excellent conversation, much more comprehensive than I think I've heard anywhere. I think really there's a lot of things under the surface. I myself am quite surprised and really shocked, I think, at the not necessarily the level of, I guess I would call, you know, racism and misogyny that we've seen lately, but the fact that it's kind of come back out in the open. And I think that people will vote sometimes based on those, unfortunately, on those impulses that they would not even admit to a to a pollster. So I do think that regardless of what Hillary Clinton's attributes are, I do think that you are correct, and I think that all the way down the line in politics, for many reasons, women have not been adequately represented. I think there's still I think in a lot of ways it's still kind of a boys' club, as we see in business and other things. And I don't know what the solution is for that, but I think you're very, very astute in picking up on that.
Jerry, thanks for the call. You've been nodding throughout that comment, Vivian.
Well, I think Jerry, unfortunately, is correct. If you look at Missouri's statewide constitutional office holders, there are six statewide constitutional offices, beginning with governor. There was a time not long ago when half of those offices were held by women, and they're now all held by men, because there isn't really the network or the pipeline to continue to refill it, to get in there. And there are a lot of guys, I'll say men, some of them quite young, who don't even think that there is any kind of barrier to their running for a statewide office and stand up. And then sometimes the women who have been pondering it are discouraged, or but personally and by other people saying, well, you know, you're already so old, and this young man needs a leg up, so we're going to all support him.
It looks like we might have a female candidate for governor this year in Missouri. Catherine Hathaway is announced.
Well, it'd be 2 years from now.
Two years from now. But that would be something different for Missouri. All righty. I have a note here that reflecting on the potential Hillary Clinton presidency, even though Farida doesn't think that necessarily is going to happen, we might have a first man. Mm-hmm. We might have Bill Clinton in that instead of a first lady.
Right. And one of the things that comes up is, what would we call him? What would his role be? And obviously his own political life makes it even more complicated. And I think that was often a criticism that Hillary had to kind of contend with in the last election in 2008, actually, was, would he really be exercising power from behind the scenes? And would he be able to do the ceremonial roles that haven't always really been done by the first ladies, actually, historically speaking? And it's an interesting question and something that we really have no idea how it would work in the United States. It happens in other countries, and the world doesn't come to an end. I'm being sarcastic. that somehow there are these issues that people, you know, will mention about, you know, even being able to imagine, really, a man basically performing some of the more symbolic aspects of that role, which it's mainly that. It's only been in the last few decades more consistently where first ladies have exercised maybe more of this unofficial policy role, which people also have a problem with, as we've seen with, again, Hillary Clinton. Maybe they can have a pet policy, but for the most part, you know, they shouldn't be political.
By people raising this mm-hmm. possibility, it almost seems like that's a thinly veiled, a thinly disguised attack.
Well, I think you're right. And I'm not clear about how the first men in states where women have been elected governor have handled it. But we don't hear much about it, which must mean that it's not an issue, in fact, that they manage to continue to carry on. And if they have a reception, they host a reception. A man can host a reception as well as a woman.
Mm. We only have about a minute left very quickly, and it's perhaps not fair. I'll start with you, Vivian. In the corporate world, women seem to be in the ascendancy here. Do you see it that way?
There are a lot more women in higher levels of positions. Yeah. There's still not a lot of women at the top level. But I think it's a merit-based system, and women do better in a merit-based system than they do in this popularity contest that we have for elections.
If allowed to do so.
Yes.
Yeah. Your thoughts, Farida?
I mean, I think corporate America is one of the most difficult contexts for women to break through and at the highest levels. And we can point to some of these successes as we can with women in politics, but it doesn't change the fact that women are still rarely there.
Well, we'll end it on that note. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Very good conversation, I think. Farida Jalalzai, UMSL political science professor and the author of Shattered, Cracked, or Firmly Intact, Women and the Executive Glass Ceiling Worldwide. Vivian Iveloff is the founder and director of the Sue Scheer Institute for Women in Public Life at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Ladies, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Enjoyed the conversation. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about ongoing issues in the Normandy School District and their broader implications throughout the state of Missouri. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.